Welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. This is episode 9 of the podcast. I am Commonweal's Head of Policy and Research, Dr. Craig DL, and today I'm joined by Lewis Akers, one of our volunteer researchers. Hello, Lewis.
Hi, Craig.
How are you getting
on? Not too bad. How are you today?
Well, I'm just back a little holiday.
Yeah, I heard you're away to Spain as part of the ULEX trip for some sort of staff training, a little retreat. What were the sort of best bits about that? What did you learn?
Yes, I spent a week up in the mountains in the Pyrenees of Catalonia, meditating, eating nice food, meeting interesting people. I'm feeling very zen and centred now. Yes, this was an organisation called ULEX who work with the Erasmus program in the EU. They pull together activists and think tanks and other third sector organizations and bring them all together in this little farmhouse up in the mountains. And we spent a week discussing how activist groups can better organize themselves and campaign more effectively. So really, really good week. Met a lot of really interesting people from a lot of diverse backgrounds. Discussed everything from how do you run a decentralized organization through how do you campaign, how do you look after yourself while doing this. This is quite a big part of it because, when you're in this very sharp end of politics, when you're fighting governments over their currency policy or whatever, it can be quite draining and quite tiring. So it was good to take a step back and kind of reflect on what we've done as an organisation. Commonweal's almost 5 years old now, and we have had some really significant wins. We've got 3 government agencies to our name now. We've got the National Investment Bank, a national infrastructure company, and a statistics agency. So in that light, Commonweal's doing really well, and it was good to just reflect on that for a week.
Yeah, one of the few organisations that can say that they've got, like, they've spawned organisations that will be bigger than themselves, you know. It's quite impressive. And coming back from it, you all seem renewed rather than, tired and on coffee all the time.
Well, this is the thing. There was no coffee up there. I was caffeine-free for an entire week.
How did you work?
I had a massive withdrawal headache for 2 days. After that, I was fine. And I've been off the caffeine ever since. I don't know how long that'll last.
I can't see it working. But while you're away, there was a couple of Commonweal papers released. So in your absence, the organisation didn't stall. You had a couple of great policy papers. One was from Friends of the Earth, is that right?
Yeah, this was a paper produced by Friends of the Earth Scotland, and Commonweal endorsed it. It's a paper called Sea Change. I'll put a link in the description underneath. Now, it discussed the future of the North Sea oil sector in light of the climate emergency, in light of the push for Green New Deal politics. And what it said was that if Scotland, if the UK wants to meet its legally binding Paris Accord targets for not exceeding 1.5 degrees worth of temperature rise, then we cannot afford to extract all of the oil in the oil fields that we're currently extracting from, right? So some of that oil needs to stay in the ground. This is even before we discuss the oil fields that are already discovered but haven't been tapped yet, and it's, completely out of the question that we go and look for even more after that. We simply don't have enough planet left to keep burning oil. So this paper goes into sort of what needs to happen to transition. We need to start now if we want to make that transition a just transition, if we want to maintain the jobs and the skills rather than simply letting places like Aberdeen rot the same way that the UK has let so many towns rot with deindustrialisation and the phasing out of the coal industry. But it also has a lot of positive things in there as well. For example, it says that the jobs in the renewable sector that we're going to need to build up to replace the fossil fuel sector will probably produce more jobs than is in the oil sector. And the jobs that are needed have skill requirements that actually largely closely match what is already being used in the offshore industry. If you take the offshore wind industry for a start, only about 14% of the jobs in the oil sector do not, you know, have skills that would not be needed in the offshore wind sector. So there's great potential to retrain and transfer a lot of jobs in the oil sector over to offshore wind. Who knows offshore engineering better than an oil rigger?
Exactly. I mean, this is a complete game changer for independence, isn't it? It completely sort of reorientates the kind of centrist views on independence and some of the reliance on oil as one of the key arguments to independence. I mean, it completely changes that whole terrain, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that we keep campaigning for, you know, Scotland's oil is gone. We need to get off of this addiction. But we have potential as well. Scotland is a massively energy-rich country, and if we can complete that transition to a renewable industry, then, you know, we're not ever going to be worrying about it running out one day. Scotland's not going to run out of wind. If it ever does, we've got bigger problems than budget cuts.
Yes, definitely.
So, and this offers one of the potentials of independence as well, because quite frankly, you know, as hesitant as the current Scottish administration, Scottish government is to this kind of change, I mean, there's no chance of it happening from a UK perspective. None whatsoever. They don't care about this at all.
Well, I mean, at least Sturgeon's talking about a Green New Deal and has. I mean, the rhetoric's there. We just need the action and the planning and Commonweal's working on plans for a Green New Deal just now, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, the rhetoric's there and some minor policy changes have happened. I mean, the announcement a couple of weeks ago that the Scottish Government was going to cancel its plans to cut air passenger duty, for instance, was predicated largely on the Green New Deal targets. And that's scrapping that cut is another policy that Commonweal's been advocating for 3 years now, so we're really glad to see that happen. The Green New Deal is right up the agenda now. The Scottish Government has committed to a Green New Deal. They haven't come out with that much in the way of detail quite yet, but Commonweal is going to be spending this year really pushing this idea. So we've been gathering together experts in all of the major economic sectors, and we're going to start producing blueprints, timetabled, costed blueprints on how we become a Green New Deal country by transitioning our housing sector, our transport sector, energy, agriculture, and our economy. You know, one of the big problems with the global economy is the consumerist idea that we're only going to be fulfilled beings if we keep buying more stuff. That's not sustainable in a finite planet.
Yeah.
So we need to completely reconfigure a lot of what we're doing.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole economic arguments about, you know, infinite growth is just, you know, that needs to be addressed as well alongside all the other arguments as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, economies should be working for people. They should be working for happiness and well-being and all of the metrics that actually mean something.
Yeah.
But right now, all we seem to be is focused on growth.
Yeah.
And that's, no matter how you cut it, that's not sustainable.
Yeah. And kind of taking a stiff step away from this paper just now, there was another paper released while you were away in Spain as well.
Yes, so Commonweal's Energy Policy Working Group produced a paper called Just Warmth. Again, I'll put a link below. And it is the first step in what will be this programme of papers on Green New Deal politics. So this paper was looking at Scotland's heating sector. Currently, it's a very quite an inefficient sector. Every house has its own boiler, and it's quite an inefficient way to run a heating network. We don't really think of heat as a service. We think of it as a product. So we think of gas and electricity and water as utilities, whereas a lot of places also include heat as a utility. So they have networks of distributed heating systems. Where your community will have a heating system and the heat is piped to every home, and that's a much more efficient way to run your heating network. So the paper goes into the technical details of how that can start to be rolled out in Scotland. It's used in some places. Some blocks of flats already have this, but it could be rolled out to other blocks. It could be rolled out to more tenement housings, but it can also be rolled out to rural areas, which is a bit more technically challenging. But the paper goes into the detail of how that can be done.
And this is already massively popular in many areas in the continent, isn't it? It's already that there is, you know, it's demonstrable.
It's normal.
You know, it's normal to be done. It's not something that seems weird or radical, but because we're in the UK, it seems to be this bizarre idea, you know.
It's considered completely normal
in
a lot of places. One of the places that's particularly highlighted in the paper is Russia and the former Soviet bloc, where this was virtually ubiquitous. Although, with the caveat that a lot of those heating systems are coal-fired, or at least gas-fired, so we're not going to be replicating that heating system. But I know that the Energy Working Group is now working on further work on how we decarbonise the heating system of Scotland. Right now, heat makes up about 50-odd percent of Scotland's energy use, but only a small fraction of it is sourced from renewable sources. So it's going to be one of the big sectors to change if we want to become a zero carbon nation. And as I say, the Energy Group's going to come out with a paper soon on how that can be done.
So looking at some of the alternatives that could be used to provide energy for Scotland's homes and...
Yeah, everything from electricity to biogas to hydrogen, it'll go through all these options.
And today in the office, we've been talking a little bit about the UN report on poverty that's just been brought out today. Would you mind sort of giving us a brief overview on that? I mean, it's quite a scathing report. In the report, it was said that these cuts are purely ideological and have been since 2010, and that they've had sort of tragic consequences for, you know, people in Britain. I mean, now we've got one-fifth of people in Britain in poverty. That's about 14 million people. I mean, it's incredible that... You know, we still see ourselves as a sort of modern, civilised nation, you know.
The background to this report was the UN Special Rapporteur on Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston, visited the UK, toured the UK for a fortnight, diving into a lot of the places that have been really deeply affected by the UK's austerity politics, and pulling out the stories that you don't see often in the headlines, and you certainly don't see quoted by the Conservative government who are implementing these policies. There were some summaries of the reports and some talking points have come out in previous months, but today the full report was published, and it is not a happy read. It's a frank and really quite shocking read in many ways. The language in it is very blunt when he just comes out and boldly states things like, you know, this policy looks like it's trying to recreate a Dickensian workhouse.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much one of those scathing comments in there. You're used to reading reports and them being fairly formal in their language, but this is, you know, the extent to which this is a problem is reflected in that report by how kind of brutal the language is. And I think even for people like me and you who are would consider ourselves in the political know, it's quite a shocking read, and that's saying something, because, you know, we could fully realise the extent of Tory poverty, Tory austerity, and it's shocking for us. I mean, it must be bad.
I think that the UK government was really hoping that it would be one of those very dry and formal reports that they could just simply ignore. They can't, not with this, and I really hope folk out there don't let them ignore it. They've already come out and said that it's wildly inaccurate and not reflective at all of reality. But, you know, I think Alston has said the exact same thing of UK UK government sources when they're discussing their policies. The section on universal credit is particularly blunt in this regard, where it said that the that whenever he talked to UK government ministers about universal credit, they said that it was that their comments were overwhelmingly positive. There was absolutely nothing wrong with this policy. Yet when he talked to virtually anyone who was on universal credit, they told them how terrible it was. I think it's every single area where universal credit has been rolled out, there has been a rise in poverty and a rise in rent arrears and a rise in all kinds of other issues. It's directly linked. There's no escaping it. It's a humanitarian disaster of a policy. Personally, I think it needs to be canned. It needs to be chucked to the dustbin of history, and the careers of anyone who has ever defended it needs to go with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the report talks about the systematic demiseration of people. I mean, do you think that's a sort of, I suppose, an attempt by the Tory government to disempower people, to stop them being politically active, to stop them challenging, you know, the wishes of you know, corporations and the Tory government, and I suppose, you know, seeing the sort of society that we want to see?
It's the systematic nature of the policies that is the most shocking.
Yeah.
We're constantly told that this is austerity was a necessity after the 2008 crash, to tighten the belt after the excesses of the pre-crash year. Yeah. This was all about fiscal responsibility and prudence, when Olsen has said that no, this is a deliberate attempt to socially engineer the UK to essentially complete the Thatcherite job.
Yeah.
Of scrapping society and turning us all into self-interested, self-realised individuals and fully self-responsible individuals. And if you're poor, it's simply because you're feckless and you haven't worked hard enough. You just need to work harder and you will get out of poverty. Yet Olsen has said that even in theory, this doesn't work. 60% of households that are in poverty have someone in there who works.
Yeah.
You know, working yourself out of poverty is not that easy, as anyone who has ever worked their arse off while being on the poverty line knows.
Yeah.
And there was also a key section on asylum seekers, where Olsen talked about the paradox of this thinking, where, you know, the government is trying to tell you that the route out of poverty is to work, and yet asylum seekers are directly banned from working. So he said that destitution seems to be a design feature.
Yeah.
Of UK policies when it comes to asylum seekers, and that's appalling.
I mean, it really is full of the sort of kind of negative sound bites that, you know, journalists and newspapers can really make good use of, and deservingly so, because the report is just shocking. I mean, they talk about this sort of, he talks about this like sort of work-based solution to you know, poverty, which the sort of Tory government has been employing, but that solution only works if you have, you know, well-paid jobs that people feel like they're valued in, with trade unions that represent them. I mean, I suppose that ties into the Green New Deal stuff. These sort of high-skilled Green New Deal jobs could be a work-based solution out of poverty, but they don't exist just now, so there is no solution, you know, in work.
But you also need access to those jobs.
As well, yeah.
So if you're in a rural area in the north of England with very poor transport links and very little investment in your local economy, you can't get access to those kind of jobs.
Yeah.
If you are a single mother who, you know, has other priorities in their lives, then you can't always get access to the childcare you need to get yourself into the workplace, and you might not even want to be spending your entire life working to pay the childminder anyway.
Yeah.
And if you're disabled, again, if you may have particular needs that are not being met by the workplace, and you can't get the help you need because the government has cut away all of the social services. This is another thing that Olsen highlighted, that in the race to cut public services, it's left people with trying to fill the gap. David Cameron's idea of the big society was fundamentally premised on the idea that if the government stopped paying for stuff, you know, volunteers would step in and fill the gap. And in so many cases, they have. I mean, there are so many unsung heroes out there doing their absolute best to fill the gaps. But, as Olsen says in this report, you know, food banks are no substitute for government policy.
Yeah.
So people are losing access to services. They can't afford to pay for them to replace them. You know, there isn't the space or the capacity to replace them through the big society volunteers. So people are going without, and it's leading to immiseration, humiliation, complete humanitarian disaster.
I mean, even if you take away any of the emotional arguments why people shouldn't be treated in this way, I mean, in a purely economic sense, it doesn't make sense to impoverish people purposely, because
No.
people, you know, the results of that end up costing more in the long run, don't they?
Absolutely. And again, we're seeing that start to creep in with, you know, public services are being cut, so people's quality of life gets cut and they end up ill. End up having to pay for treatment in the healthcare system for conditions that wouldn't have happened had austerity not been there. So the supposed savings are, you know, they're just not there.
Yeah, they're completely watered down by anything else that, you know, the impacts that the savings have. So you end up with this vicious circle of, you know, poverty, more poverty, and then it costs the government more. So even for, you know, without even looking at it from an emotional standpoint, it just purely doesn't make sense.
No.
When you look at it with your emotional hat on as well, it's even more ridiculous and even more, you know, just it makes you even more angry. I mean, to the point that sometimes when I watch the news, I just can't even speak. Sometimes just like, what am I meant to say?
Those listening might notice that I'm being rather more animated than I usually am. That's because I really am so appallingly furious that the UK government is getting away with this, and that I know that they're just going to try to forget about this report. Yeah. I don't even think it was mentioned in PMQs today. They were too busy talking about the whole Brexit black hole that's happening and other issues of infighting within the Tory party. So yeah, they're going to try and ignore this, but you know, we can't anymore. We have to make it clear that we can't.
Yeah, I mean, we were discussing earlier as well that a couple of us had ridden in on the metro and on the tube in Glasgow, and we picked up a copy of the Metro, and it had a 5-page spread by the Department of Work and Pensions trying to debunk the apparent myths around universal credit, whatever those myths are that the Department of Work and Pensions want you to think. I mean, surely that shows that the Tory government must be to some extent scared of the impact that this report could have and actually how damning it is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they'll have known this report was coming out.
Yeah.
So I don't think that spread in the paper was
just
in
a
any
coincidence.
Way coincidental. But it's also kind of a bit weird to see a multi-page spread in a newspaper just in pure government propaganda, dressed up to look like a newspaper article. Yes, it had all the legal disclaimers at the top saying it was an advertising feature, but that made me distinctly uncomfortable to see that.
It's a bit kind of like a bit Pravda-ish, isn't it? You know, for most people would just read that and just assume it was a newspaper article, and that's them getting the facts and the information, but you know, it's not. It is propaganda that's meant to promote a certain viewpoint. There's not really that much discussion there about actually, you know, the pros and the cons of universal credit. Not that there probably is any pros, I would say.
I mean, the article itself was pretty shallow. I mean, it said one myth, universal credit doesn't work. And the answer was essentially, yes, it does. So take from that what you will.
I mean, it's no surprise that that's the analysis after, you know, this whole Brexit chaos, is it? You know? but, I mean, how does this actually, you know, impact the argument for independence? How does it bolster the arguments for independence? You know, what are the sort of things that we could do under independence, under Commonweal's sort of policy ideas that actually the UK government are actually incapable of doing?
Well, this is something that the report actually did mention, not quite independence, but it did look at the efforts that the devolved governments, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, had been doing, and said that they had actually been doing some really positive things to mitigate Tory austerity and mitigate the worst impacts of it. And off the top of the head, example of that is the Scottish government paying the bedroom tax, for instance. But it also said that these administrations have now stretched to their limit. They can't keep mitigating. Mitigation is no longer a solution. So as austerity bites harder, you know, the devolved administrations are going to have to either pass on those cuts directly or pass them on indirectly by cutting elsewhere. It's simply not an option anymore. So this is one of the things where independence comes onto the table, because if we want to have a welfare system that actually benefits all of us, if we want an actual social security system, then we need the full powers of independence to get that. We don't have room for tinkering around the edges anymore. So we need to reform the social security. We need to reform the full gamut of taxes to balance that. But as with the, what I was saying earlier about asylum seekers, we need powers over immigration.
Yes.
So that we can treat people who come to this country, especially the people who come, you know, in as desperate a situation as you can possibly imagine, and worse. We need to be able to treat them like human beings. And the UK government is not doing that.
Yeah.
And right now the Scottish government can't do much about it. So, yeah, we need independence. We need it as quickly as possible, because it will save suffering. It will probably save people's lives if we can get this right, if we can reform these systems that are causing so much hardship, so much pain. It wouldn't be so bad, really, if this was a country that was on the brink and was failing. But it's not. We constantly hear that Britain is the fifth largest economy in the world. We're a rich nation. This is not a country that is failing. It's a country that is being failed deliberately by its government, who is charging down an ideological agenda.
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous to, when you see about austerity and that the country is failing, but when you see, you know, the big pay rises that council bosses get, or, you know, the big profit margins of corporations, and you think, you know, they're not failing. We're the ones that are, you know, in the situation where, you know, we're destitute and, you know, we are being left behind. And I suppose stuff like universal basic income really does kind of offer a great kind of holistic solution to some, yeah, of these problems that we've mentioned, especially as, you know, a lot of anti-poverty groups have really spotted this as an idea that could really address poverty and really free people from work. And actually, in the age of automation, would be a great time to actually do it.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about universal basic income. We're a firm advocate of it. Other groups, like the RSA, have recently published papers on universal basic income. It's a great leveller. It's a way of making sure that everybody can meet their basic needs, and from there can fulfil their lives in ways that they want to, rather than scraping by in ways that they have to. But it's also a way of really joining a country together and giving people something to be sort of proud of, that everybody gets, in much the same way that people feel about the NHS.
Yeah.
These universal services become really popular for that reason. It's no coincidence that other services that have been sold off, like the post office, Royal Mail, you know, there's a vast majority of people want to have that renationalised, because these services are seen as vital, they're seen as useful, and they're seen as something that should be universal rather than just there for the people fortunate enough to be able to afford it.
I mean, we really are coming to a time where we kind of need I suppose, maybe like a second 1945, you know, a new kind of idea, a new kind of ideology, I suppose, to, you know, give us a little bit of hope, to give us the solutions to these problems that we're facing just now. And I really think that universal basic income is one of those ideas that's time has come, you know, that it could be as revolutionary as, you know, universal healthcare was in the post-war period. It's such an exciting idea. I mean,
this again is something that came out of the report where they said that post-war social contract was not just breaking, it was being actively torn apart. So yeah, maybe the future is a universal basic income and people getting behind a Green New Deal as a project for the next generation. That might be the way forward for Scotland, for the UK, for other countries. So I mean, there is hope there if we can get the will to start, the tool, start picking up the tools to do it, and, you know, crack on.
Yeah, and I think, like, one of the ways that you can really support some of that great work that's being done is, like, we are to, you know, to get involved in Commonweal, to join Commonweal, to support Commonweal, because, and any other organisation that kind of advocates these ideas, because that's the way that we change the world. We get involved in our communities, we get involved in organisations, we think, we discuss and we debate, and we make sure that we don't leave the thinking to someone else, because we think best about what is best for our lives, you know, at the end of the day.
And that's actually a good way to sort of round up as we come to an end of the programme here, that as we said at the start, you know, Commonweal as an organisation, we have had results, we have had made tangible changes to the fabric of Scotland. We hope to continue doing that. It does take people like yourselves to do that, to help us here. We don't get government money. We don't have advertisers throwing money at us. Commonweal is almost entirely supported by folk like yourself giving us £5 or £10 a month. So if you want to support us, if you want to get involved, you want to see, you know, what we can do to Scotland, given the chance, if you want to be a part of that, there's a link in the description that you can come along, you can offer your support. And I hope some of you will take us up on that. So I think we'll close up there. Thank you, Lewis, for coming in and having a very interesting chat.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Hope to get you back on it in the future at some point.
Definitely.
And I'll see you all next week.